What is cracking, Hope Nation? It is your friendly neighborhood Kevin Hines, and I couldn't be more excited today. Today is a great day. Today is a blessed day because today's guest is a man I've hoped to have on the show for some time. This episode is part of the My Brother's Keeper series of the Hindsights podcast, where I interview young Black individuals who have triumphed over incredible adversity to give back to their communities and communities around the world with the phenomenal work they do. Yes, today we have the honor and the privilege of speaking with Abraham Scully, an educational consultant, a dynamic speaker, a best-selling author dedicated to empowering students, educators, and educational institutions with a focus on maximizing student access and promoting a positive learning environment. Abraham provides guidance and practical strategies that drive meaningful change. Abraham's personal journey is marked by overcoming challenges and, as I said, triumphing over adversity, giving him a unique perspective that he brings to his work every single day. Through captivating storytelling and actionable advice, Abraham's speaking engagements have inspired and empowered countless individuals. His experience, expertise, and dedication make him a trusted advisor and resource for educators and educational institutions seeking to create an environment that fosters student growth and achievement. Join us as we delve into Abraham's insights and experiences and discover the wisdom he has to offer on mental health, resilience, and success. Welcome to the Hindsights podcast. We are so lucky to have you on the show, Abraham Scully. It's an honor. Glad to have you here. How are you today?
My man, it is a blessing. I am very well. Really looking forward to this conversation, and I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
Well, we're glad you're here too, brother. There's no doubt about that. Absolutely. Before we officially, you know, kind of get into the nitty gritty of your story, let's go back all the way back in the rearview mirror to the very beginning. Where and when were you born, and what was your upbringing like?
I was born in Miami, Florida. Sunny Miami, Florida. I was raised by two Jamaican immigrants who moved to the United States in pursuit of the American dream. And my upbringing was very unique. I was raised by a father who was a pastor and also a very assertive and visionary-like man. A lot of my characteristics and tendencies come straight from my daddy, whom I love. And so it was a very interesting upbringing in that I had Jamaican parents living in the United States. So a funny thing that I like to share is that it does not matter where you live. As long as you have Caribbean parents, you live in a Jamaican household, i.e. put in whatever, you know, Caribbean background you represent. So, it was interesting. I remember, you know, things that was the norm for my family growing up that wasn't typical in other families, you know, just attending elementary school, middle school, high school. But that was the way we did things because of their upbringing. So a big, I guess, transformational period during my upbringing was actually when my parents divorced. I was 14 years old and they were married for over 20 years and decided to make that that decision, and it became a transformational experience for me and our entire household. But I would say overall, great upbringing, very unique, you know, experiences and a lot of things that have shaped who I am today and the passion that I bring to the work that I do.
I love hearing it, man. I have to tell you, I was raised by my parents who adopted me and made me their son, but my family is Jamaican. My family's from Jamaica. My birth mom, the first 10 years of her life were spent in Jamaica. And we've got hundreds of cousins out there and we're hoping to do a family reunion. Because I'm adopted, I've only met the folks that are here in Georgia and the folks that are in the Bay Area and in Florida that are part of my family, beautiful Jamaican family and mixed family. And I can't wait to go to Jamaica and meet the whole tribe. I'm so excited. I'm hoping to document the trip and share the story of my mother and her coming to America and having me and all that stuff. So it's gonna be incredible. But let's get back to you, my friend. Let's get into this first really important question. Can you share with us a bit about your personal journey with mental health and how it has shaped your work today?
So I kind of alluded to an experience that was life altering for me. And at the time I didn't know it. And it wasn't until, which I love the name of your podcast, Hindsight. But now kind of looking back, I realized that coming from a divorced household can shift your mental health and how you see the world. But I didn't know that at 14, and through a lot of therapy and a lot of conversation and observation, just looking at other people's relationships, I realized that the way I see the world is actually warped based off of the experience that I had, you know, coming from a divorced family. So it started there, and kind of seeing certain things that became the norm just because it was the norm in our household. And then fast forward, developing a lot of negative habits, you know, coming from, you know, experiencing the divorce to then being the first in my family to go off to college and experiencing some of those challenges as a first generation student, you know, being away from home as well. It was consistent themes as far as different habits that I had formed, different behaviors that, you know, I was comfortable in that weren't necessarily healthy. And it catapulted me into understanding, why am I the way that I am? Why do I do things the way that I do? And how can I grow? If I can use one word to describe who I am as a person, it would be growth. And so one of my top core values is growth. If I ever feel like I'm in a situation where I'm stagnant for whatever reason, I get antsy. Like I literally would have a reaction, like a physical reaction, because I'm always looking for opportunities for growth. And it doesn't even have to be something big. It can be the smallest thing. Like I'm practicing gratitude, you know, during this time of my life, during this, and that's a form of growth. So, you know, getting older and really looking at, you know, I don't like conflict. I have a hard time having vulnerable and transparent conversations. I don't like experiencing emotions that are quote unquote negative. And after exploring these things, I realized, well, it's because of some of my history. And I can stay this way, or I can learn new information and then take that information to grow and become a better human being. So it's informed my work just as far as experiencing mental health challenges, you know, as a teenager. And then, you know, those mental health challenges kind of exacerbating when I was in college, and then growing throughout life, just learning new information and finding opportunities to grow where I don't feel like I am the best that I can be in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Incredible insights there, and important ones at that. As an African-American male, what were your unique challenges, the ones that you faced regarding mental health, and how did you address them in the work you do?
So one of the main things is, unfortunately, as an African-American male, and then you put in the aspect that I got Jamaican parents, we don't typically talk about mental health. We don't talk about mental illness. We don't talk about anything in relation to things that we cannot see. I'll just put it that way. And I didn't know that that wasn't normal. I thought that's how everyone operated. Whenever they felt something that they couldn't necessarily explain or see, I thought it was the norm just to not talk about it. But I realized that, no, that's the case for a group of individuals, and African-American males are, you know, that's one group of individuals where we just don't talk about mental health at all. And from there, I realized that, you know, I am uniquely struggling with talking about these things. But the more I talk with friends, peers, colleagues, we all struggle with the same thing. And it can be something as simple as, today, I'm just not having a good day today. It's hard to say that as an African-American male, because we typically are not only seen as the protector and provider in our relationships, or the strong one in our relationships, but we also have that expectation for ourselves. And so it can be difficult to say, well, today I'm actually not feeling it. I don't have the energy to do these things. And so it's informed my work just by having that understanding that this is a shared experience. And so if I'm going to open up and share with another African-American male, hey, it's difficult for me at times to be vulnerable and be transparent. Then just in knowing that that is the case for many African-American males, it builds connection and an opportunity for relationship and conversation, because it wasn't until I had conversations for myself where I realized it's okay to have these conversations. It's okay to not be okay. I know we hear that phrase a lot. It's okay. And it wasn't until I heard someone else say it and they kind of, you know, became a mentor for me just in them being able to say it out loud, and it empowered me to say it for myself. So through our work and what I do and everything that I do, it's more so understanding that my experience, as you know, just as it's unique to me, it's a shared experience for many different people. And so instead of keeping it to myself, I can use it as an opportunity for connection and growth.
You know, one thing I know about you is that your experience with depression is a powerful part of your story. How has that experience influenced your approach to mental health advocacy as a whole?
You know, when I first was diagnosed with depression, I had no idea what depression was. I was a college freshman, just recently moved from Miami to Pensacola, Florida. And just for the listeners, for context, that's about 700 miles from each other. And so, you know, I'm in this new city, new town, no family, no friends. And I'm this college student who's working full time, has my own apartment, full course load of classes, figuring things out. So I went from being a very optimistic, outgoing, enthusiastic, motivated person to becoming overwhelmed with stress and not able to do much of anything. So I had enough self-awareness to know that I wasn't myself and I wasn't doing okay, but I didn't have any language or any reference point to say, maybe I'm struggling with my mental health. So thankfully I had a good friend of mine who recognized that, you know, that first semester of mine, like I was very outgoing. I was, you know, hanging out with friends, meeting new people, engaging with other people. And she noticed that I shifted from that to being more isolated, more withdrawn. And even when I would hang out with her and other friends, I was present, but I wasn't there. And she saw these things and she took note of it. And then one day she just asked me the question, hey, what's going on? I'm recognizing these things and I'm a little concerned. Do you want to talk about it? We ended up having a conversation. I ended up sharing with her as much as I could articulate, because another thing with African-American males is that we struggle to articulate what we're feeling because we suppress our feelings for so long. We don't know how to feel and we don't know what we're feeling. Just a side note before I go back to the, you know, the experience for me, it wasn't until I did immense amount of therapy and was exposed to a, I think it's called a feelings wheel or an emotion wheel. And basically it's a series, it's maybe 30 or 40 or so different feelings or emotions that the human being can experience. It wasn't until I saw that, in my 20s that I learned that I had other feelings and emotions besides just being happy and being mad. I didn't know that I could feel betrayed. I didn't know that I can feel, you know, hurt, or, you know, these different things you just don't have the language for. So as an African-American male, we suppress all of these emotions. And then someone asks us, how are you feeling? And we have no words beyond I'm good or I don't know. And so I'm in this place where, you know, this friend sees these things and she's able to obviously recognize that I'm not doing well. And she was bold enough to have the conversation. And after sharing all of what I knew to say, which were, you know, for me at the time, it was, I know I'm not sleeping. I'm just, you know, wired at night for whatever reason. I'm not eating. I don't feel motivated. I don't feel like myself. That was the language that I knew. That's all I knew. And from hearing that, she said, it sounds like you might be depressed. There's a counseling center. You can get help. You don't have to do this by yourself. So I trusted her enough to give it a try. I sat down with the mental health professional, went through my first assessment, had my first meeting with the mental health professional in my life. Bro, I was terrified. I was like, oh, first of all, I don't want no one to see me walking into the counseling center. Second of all, I don't know what this person is going to say or think, because there's this old white lady that I've never met in my life, and she's asking me all these, you know, deep questions. This is just weird. So I'm terrified the whole experience. But one thing about the experience is I was so desperate to get better that I was willing to do something hard. Mm. So sat down with her, did the assessments, and then lo and behold, I'm diagnosed with major depressive disorder. That started me on this journey of treatment and recovery. And from that experience, I started to realize something. Started to realize that depression is a real thing. And it's not this flaw that makes me a weak person or a bad person or an incompetent person. It's a real condition. It's a health condition. Just as if I went to the doctor and they said, you have a cold or you have a flu. And that changed the game for me, because now I had the language and now I felt like I was seen. And I felt like now I have something to do about it. Whereas before, I just thought I was going crazy. I'm like, well, you know, I'm trying all these things. I'm not feeling like myself. Maybe I have to accept this as my new normal and figure out life as this just isolated down person that I don't recognize. And for me, that was the transformational, you know, I would say interruption in my life. My friend saw something. She said something. I encouraged me to talk to someone. I spoke to someone and started on this journey of shifting my perspective and trying something different.
It's so telling to how you show people with your words now what they can do to change their perspective when they just start going through something. Like you didn't know what you didn't know. And yeah. Here you are going through it, and you get to this therapy session and it shifts your entire perspective. As a part Black man myself, mixed kid, I was raised by all white parents, but even with those parents who taught me to talk about my emotions, who taught me to speak up when I was in pain, who taught me to tell the truth when I was struggling, even with all of that, when I was ready to take my life off the Golden Gate Bridge, I silenced my pain. I buried all my struggles because I thought if I told them what I was going through, they would lock me up in a white-walled padded room and throw away the key. That was my belief. So I really, really vibe with what you're saying here. Could you discuss the key insights or the lessons you've learned from your own struggles with mental health that you believe could benefit others? You've touched upon some of them, but define those a little bit.
Yeah, I would say the first thing is education. And that was the difference maker for me, because now I understood that depression is a mood disorder that affects the way I think, the way I feel, the way I behave. And so there are certain things that I can look out for that will help me to know if I'm dealing with depression or not. And just that education alone empowered me to now say, this is a thing that is identified by these signs and symptoms. And when I'm experiencing these signs and symptoms, I can go to this or that person for additional help if I need additional help. So I would say the first thing, you know, is education. And it can be as simple as finding a book, right, that is practical and tangible enough, especially if you've never been exposed to this type of content. And I mean, we're on your podcast, so I'm sure you talk about this all the time and educate. But, you know, just as far as learning more about language, right? The art of being broken, how storytelling saves lives. So if you haven't gotten the book,
Practical tools, tens of them, practical tools to better your brain, mind, behavioral, mental, physical health, and well-being. But please keep going, my friend.
And that's the point. So for me, it was, yes, I'm a student who has required reading for being a student at this university. But the reality is I'm also a student of life. And so if there's an opportunity for me to learn something that I don't know, because just like you said very well, you don't know what you don't know. And if you don't know it, not having the information is no longer an excuse. And it hasn't been an excuse for a very long time because people have been writing books for a very long time. Yeah. And now we got Google, we got AI, you know what I mean? So it's like, what don't I know? Where do I feel stuck? Who has the information? Let me get the information. And for me, the information changed my life because now I know what depression looks like. And then I start learning more about myself and I know what depression looks like for me because depression looks like something different for different people. But now after studying myself and having the information that I read and learned about, I now can take that information and say, what does this mean for me? How can I apply this to me? So that's the first thing, educating ourselves. And the more we educate ourselves, and this is the funny thing about it. The more we learn, the more we realize we don't know nothing. But that's a great thing because that means that there's so much more to learn.
Yes.
Right? And so when I learned about depression, I started to then learn about anxiety. And then I started to learn about bipolar disorder. And then I started to learn about schizophrenia. And then I started to learn about overall mental health and the difference between mental health and a mental health condition or a mental illness. And then I'm starting to have these moments in my life where I'm thinking to myself, man, did I really go this far in life without having this information? And then it's also, okay, now that I have the information, how can I enhance my own life and my own well-being, you know, with the information that I have? So that's the first thing, education. The second thing is storytelling. I love that you focus on storytelling because stories have been around from the very beginning. And a lot of people, when we have interactions, we remember more the way someone made us feel because of the story that they shared versus the bullet points that we use to teach them something specific. And so as a speaker myself, a communicator, I'm always focused on, okay, yes, there's this lesson that I have, but how can I wrap it so well in a story so that whether or not this person remembers who I am, they remember the story that then brings them to this lesson that can hopefully enhance their life. And if I could say anything to anyone around your question, it is educate yourself and share and listen to other people's stories, because I've learned so much by just listening. I mean, just like you, Kevin, like the first time I heard your story, I think it was through a video, and it was years ago. I was in undergrad, and even though I probably didn't remember your name, I remembered your story. And anytime an opportunity would come up that had to do with you and your story, there was a guy that I heard who had this devastating experience, and he survived jumping from the Golden Gate Bridge. And maybe I didn't remember your name, right? But now it's come full circle to where it's like, yeah, of course I know your name. And now, you know, we do similar work. And so it's like sharing our stories, listening to others' stories, but then always finding opportunities to educate ourselves as it relates to mental health.
Brother, I think we have to share a stage together one of these days. That would be incredible. I would love that.
Absolutely.
Okay. Abraham, in your opinion, what are some of the most pressing issues surrounding youth mental health today, especially for young Black males?
Support. I think one of the things that adults are doing incorrectly is they're not supporting in the way that young Black males need support. Oftentimes, our way of supporting is, you can do it. Come on, get out of bed. Like, you can figure this thing out. And so we're stripping the young African-American male from his human experience, which is comprehensive in its nature. No one is a robot. No one is on all the time. No one is superhuman. right? And there's this common misconception that, first of all, mental illness or mental health conditions are not real. And so when we see certain signs, we don't treat them as if they need unique support. But the other piece is that young men, or I would say young people in general, don't need additional support. Like, if I were to say a few different signs that people see on a regular basis, whether it's within, you know, if they have kids or if they work with youth, there are certain signs that we see all the time, but we don't see them as signs that are worth reaching out and checking in with that young person, because we say things like they're going through a phase, or they'll just kind of snap out of it. Or maybe something's going wrong, but you know, it's not that serious. It's not worth a conversation. And so we bypass, it's all in their head.
Yeah.
Right. We bypass all of these opportunities that allow us to create spaces for young people to say, you know, as a matter of fact, I'm not doing well. Let me share a story with you. I went to a charter school when I was in, so from eighth grade to 12th grade, I went to a charter school. It was K through 12. And thankfully, I had a mentor of mine. His name is Joe. I hope Joe can see this podcast. He's still a good friend of mine to this day. But Joe, he was my guidance counselor in eighth grade, and ended up, as I kind of matriculated through high school, he ended up just happened to be the guidance counselor for the next grade that I was in. So it was a pretty cool situation. So we got close really fast. But the interesting thing about me and Joe's relationship is Joe met me when I was going through my go-throughs because my parents were divorcing. So Joe got to see the worst of Abraham. I'm talking about not caring about life, not caring about people's feelings, in and out of school suspension, drinking, smoking, not like shifting to this just menace, right, to society, right? Joe got to, that was Joe's introduction to me, right? And so Joe saw beyond all of the behaviors that everyone else saw, and he saw the Abraham that you see today, which is this national speaker, best-selling author, blah, 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 whatever, all these other things. Joe saw the potential even before the potential was realized. And what Joe did is Joe would reach out to me, and I would get in trouble pretty regularly when I was in eighth grade, ninth grade, 10th grade. And I'd get, you know, kicked out, I was sent out of class, in school suspension, out of school suspension. That was kind of like the regular. And so Joe would see all these things, and then Joe would just kind of reach out to me. Hey, you want to have lunch with me during your lunch hour? You know, and Joe was very persistent. And there were times where I looked at Joe and I said, Joe, I don't want to have lunch with you, Joe.
I want your help.
Right? I'll need your help. And you, my friends are at lunch, right? I want to hang out with my friends. But Joe is very persistent. And Joe got me to finally say yes to eating lunch in his office. And there were times during my lunch hour with Joe where I would sit in his office, he would sit at his desk, and he was on his computer doing work, and it was as if I wasn't even there. Joe didn't ask me any questions. He didn't pester me about anything. It was just a space. And there were times where I would go to his office and I would like, you know, why did he invite me if we're not even talking? And then there were times where he would say something. How's it going in this class? How's it going in that class? And then it'll just go silent. So after a while, I would say weeks of this, right? Just the consistency of building a foundation. And I don't know if Joe knew what he was doing at the time, but it was a genius move, especially for someone who is young, Black, parents are going through divorce, and the situation that I was in. After a while, I got comfortable in Joe's office, the physical space of his office. And then because I started to think to myself, well, he doesn't want anything from me. He's not asking me any questions. He just wants me in this presence. So I thought to myself, well, I mean, there's no harm, no foul, there's nothing. So I felt comfortable in proximity with Joe. Very soon, I started to feel comfortable enough to have small talk with Joe. And so he would ask me questions. And instead of just saying yes or no to his questions, or I don't know, I would say yes and then actually give some context. Or I would say no and actually give some context. But Joe is very intentional about building that relationship. Long story short, I found myself opening up with Joe one day. And I was telling him how I felt about the fact that my parents were now divorced and things were crazy at the house. And again, Joe just created that space. And I think about now in hindsight, right? I think about the fact that Joe had no ulterior motive besides creating a safe space for me. It led me to see that I can speak to this guy. I can open up. There's no judgment. I can open up if I feel like it, and I don't have to open up if I don't feel like it. And the choice that I made because he created that safety is that I started to open up. And he was one of the first persons that I actually spoke with. And it wasn't that other people didn't initiate a conversation, but it wasn't in the way and with such intentionality that Joe had, where he was willing to be patient. He was willing to wait out however long it took. He was willing to do a little bit more to reach me. And we ended up having conversations and ended up becoming good friends. And to this day, he's a good friend of mine. And we're both older. But one of the ways that adults and just in general that we drop the ball when supporting young people and specifically young African-American males is that we don't put forth the effort to build relationship, and it takes time. And so we see these behaviors. We see that they're smoking. We see that they're drinking. We see that they're doing all the things we tell them not to do. And we take that behavior and we label them as that versus making the effort to build relationship. And I don't know if my life would look the way it looks today if it wasn't for Joe. And I'm 28 years old now, and I met Joe when I was 14, 15 years old. And I still remember how he made me feel. And I don't know if I think I have called him since and just said, thank you for that. And he didn't even know that it meant so much to me in that moment. But the parents who are listening to this, the teachers who are listening to this, the adults who support or mentor young people who are listening to this, we got to put forth the effort, because when we look at the suicide rates, you know, specifically among young Black males, right? It's crazy. It's not necessary. It's preventable. And it requires that we slow down, we pay attention, and we build relationship. And it can be something as simple as a smile. I taught middle school. I taught sixth graders for about a year and a half. I lasted for about a year and a half. These kids, boy, man, I don't know how my teachers did it, but I lasted for about a year and a half. And one thing I realized being a teacher and a mentor and sometimes father figure to young people, specifically young men, you don't have to do too much to build relationship. The way I started was just a smile. They didn't see other Black men smile at them, right? And so I would just smile and just say, hey, you know, how you doing? Right? Just the energy alone. Yeah. And that is what led to opportunities where I had some of the quote unquote worst sixth graders who would ask to come and have their lunch in my classroom during my lunch hour.
Full circle.
Bro, it was crazy. And I'm thinking to myself, I didn't do much. And I wasn't even thinking about it. So imagine if I had intentionality behind building this relationship. And this is, quote unquote, the worst sixth grader, right? The one who's doing all the things. And he's asking, hey, I want to have lunch in Mr. Scully's classroom. And they can't say no. I mean, he'll make some noise. So it's like those things like that, where it's like, if we play a role in a young person, specifically a young Black male's life, you got to do just a little bit more, right? Look beyond those things that we label as bad and see the person. And more than likely, it'll create opportunities to build relationships that last forever.
Mm-hmm. The behavior is not the person. The behavior is they're not bad people. They're not wrong. They're in pain. And when you look at our culture and you see that idea of growing up with even fathers and mothers that say, be quiet. Don't tell me about your pain. I want you to just get through, just knuckle up, you know, white knuckle it and ball your fists up and keep going. And, you know, I didn't have support when I was your age. So you have what you have. And, you know, it's fascinating what you've done with what Joe did for you. You now do not just for your sixth graders, but every audience you touch with your words experiences this message of how to be seen in the face of insurmountable pain and how to be heard, and their voices are heard, because that's all that people want.
Yeah, that's
people,
it.
People of all walks of life, black, white, otherwise, want to be seen and they want to be heard. That's the truth of the matter. And we need to do a better job of giving them that in every aspect of their lives from a young age on up, whether you're a parent, whether you're a teacher, a counselor, or a staff member, whether you are the custodian at the school, you can help a student be seen and heard. You can do that. I'll tell you a story real quick because it comes to mind in this moment. I was in my third psych ward stay of 10, third involuntary psych ward stays. I don't tell the story often. And I didn't feel seen and I didn't feel heard. And I felt abandoned by my family. That's how I personally felt. Maybe it wasn't entirely true, but that's how I felt. And in that psych ward, if you weren't helping yourself, they were not really helping you. Okay. And I started to get better and I'm starting to help myself, starting to do the work to get better and the healing. But there was this custodian. We called him Bruce Bruce. He was a black man who played in the NFL. And here he finds himself humbled by custodian work, but he loved his job like nobody's business. And he would come in every single week and he would use that big giant plug-in machine to kind of like buff the floors, right? And he would allow me the space to walk around with him as he buffed the entire psych ward, the H-shaped psych ward. He would allow me the space to walk with him and just shoot the, you know what, just talk out of my, you know, ears, talk out of his ears, and just tell him how I felt, what I was going through, how angry I was that I was in the psych ward again, how much of a hard time I was having. And Bruce wouldn't say much, but he would listen. Like, he was the best listener I'd come across in my entire life up until that point. He was incredible. He could teach a master class in listening. And he was just there for me. And I'll never forget him. And I wish I was in touch with him today, because I would desperately want to say thank you for being there for me, because he was better than a therapist. He was better than my psychiatrist. He was better than the nurses, and they were incredible, but he was top notch. And he was just there, and he wasn't even trying to be. He just had to be there. You know, it was his job. And he was there for me, and it was incredible. So I just wanted to say this. The work you are doing, Abraham, to save and change lives all across this country for people that look like us and beyond is incredible. It's endearing and it's powerful. And never forget that. Know the impact you are having on this world. All right, but let me just
thank you, brother. I appreciate that.
Back to the questions at hand here. You know, let's really get into the work you're doing. You're speaking and consulting for colleges and universities all across the country. How do you tailor your message to resonate with young adults in university communities across the United States?
Yeah, the first thing is to remember, just as an individual, remember that there is no one size fits all approach to anything. I mentioned in the beginning of the show that as a human being, we are comprehensive, we're complex in nature, right? And so just because me and the other person is black, it doesn't mean that we think and have the same perspective. And just because we look the same, we're the same height, we play the same sport, right? There's so many complexities in being a human being. And so I think just understanding that at its core helps to even approach the work in such a customized, tailored way. So let's talk about an institution at large, right? In working with an institution, a school in Georgia, my approach is going to be drastically different than if I'm working with a school in, let's say, Missouri, right? Geographically, I'm in two different places, right? Geographically, there are experiences that people who are in the south side of Georgia experience that are unique to those individuals than those who are in the south side of Missouri, wherever I'm at that institution. And so my first approach is always in question. What's going on with your campus? Do you have a counseling center? What do students do when they recognize that they need additional help? If you don't have a counseling center on campus, what are the community resources that you refer your students to? And in understanding the scope and the lay of the land for that institution, I'm able to tailor my conversation with whether it's the entire campus or a specific group of students so that it makes the most sense for them. I think in our work, there can sometimes be this idea that utilizing formal mental health support is the answer. But for many people, formal mental health support may not be the answer. And when I say formal mental health support, I'm talking about maybe sitting down with a licensed mental health counselor or social worker for something like talk therapy or trauma therapy, or psychiatry, medication for a mental health condition. When I say formal mental health support, that's what I'm talking about. But for many people, informal mental health support is actually more effective, especially in the beginning where someone may not be used to or comfortable utilizing formal mental health support. So I'm talking about anything from having, peer support groups, circles, helping them to understand themselves enough to have conversations with their friends and with their family members. These are all things that I take into consideration. In addition to, there are certain institutions that don't have services on campus. So I can't come into this institution that doesn't have counseling services, unfortunately, and try to encourage these students to seek counseling services that don't exist on this campus. And so for me, the customization comes always with a conversation first. I want to, have a discussion with all the stakeholders as it pertains to the mental health initiatives or wellness initiatives on the campus to get a great understanding as much as I can as far as what is accessible and what is being utilized currently. And then from there, obviously demographics plays a role as far as who I'm speaking to. So just understanding the nature there and then seeing where in my life do I have a story that can resonate with whoever I'm speaking to. If anyone ever sees me speak, it doesn't matter what I'm doing. If I have 5 minutes to speak to, a crowd of 2,000 people or a crowd of 5 people, if I have 5 minutes, 4.5 of those minutes is going to be me telling a story because I understand the power of storytelling and the impact of storytelling. I'm not going to use those 5 minutes to give you facts about mental health. That's going to go in one ear and out the other. But if I try to find and cultivate a really good story that connects with you and your own experiences for 4.5 minutes, I can use 30 seconds to give you a strong lesson that ties it all together. And I personally have seen that to be more impactful than solely trying to educate. So that's my way of customization, is I'm always trying to understand who I'm speaking to and then see where there's connection, because we're all connected in the grand scheme of things. I learned today that you got Jamaican parents. I'm like, yo, you might really be my brother. So it's like these little things that, once I hear you share something, I feel comfortable to share something. And then I feel connected with you in just 30 seconds. And if I can build that connection, then I can impart, information. I can give you education. I can do all these other things. So in terms of, the tailoring of it, I think that's important. That's important. And that's critical for anyone in a position to mentor or provide support to whoever they're providing support to. There's a huge concern around cultural competency within the mental health industry and space, and you know, there being a lack of cultural competency. And I think a big part of that is rooted in believing that there is a one size fits all approach to supporting the client that you're working with, the students that you're working with, the child that you're working with, the friend that you're in relationship with. There's never a one size fits all approach. And going back to Bruce, like, learn how to listen, right? Like, learn how to sit there and listen and understand and be curious and ask questions and do whatever you need to do to get an understanding of where this person is, and then build connection from there so that whatever you say next, it can actually be received.
Mind blown, brother. Fantastic explanation there and answer to that question. Storytelling, stories are 22 times more memorable than statistics or facts.
Wow, I didn't know that.
And so when someone tells a story like you do on stage, or you do in a video, or I do in a video or on stage, or in a book, people take in that story. They hear that story, they read that story, they watch that story. They then, the neural pathways in our brains actually sync up with the storyteller. That's where empathy for what they're going through comes in. True empathy, in the depths of the word empath, comes in that moment. And then when they're struggling at home after that story's been told, read, or heard, when they're struggling at home and they're thinking about the pain they're going through, they recall your story.
Wow.
The story you told. And they go, if Abraham can do it, so can I. If Kevin can do it, so can I. And they feel empowered. It's brain science. They feel empowered to go defy the odds and defeat their pain. It's incredible. Wow. How impactful storytelling truly is. I really would love if you could share one really great success story, or impactful moment from your speaking engagements that highlight the positive impact of your work. If you could pick one moment, what would it be?
I was asked to speak at a national conference in DC a few years ago, and it was a pretty big deal for me, just as far as the opportunity. It was run by an organization that's pretty well respected in terms of mental health and student mental health support. And so I was excited to get the invitation. And as far as what I did at that engagement, I was a part of a panel discussion, right? So I was a very small piece of the big thing, right? And so at most, I may have spoken for like 7 minutes, right? But again, coming back to what I see as priority, and you just shared 22%. That's a pretty big, you know, deal.
Yeah, 22 and times so, more memorable.
22 times more memorable storytelling
than,
is.
Than statistics or facts.
And so subconsciously knowing that, not having that statistic at the time, but just knowing what a story can do for you, a good story can do for you, I used the 7 minutes, the short time that I had, to share a story. I was asked a particular question and I shared a story. I didn't think anything of it. I thought to myself, well, this is a story from my experience. And my hope is that whoever's here listening to this panel discussion will feel seen, will feel heard, and will feel like they can do what they need to do to, you know, end what they're going through and get what they need in terms of support. So the panel discussion ends. I get up to go to the next session or to engage with other people. I get this young girl. She's she looked maybe, I don't know, maybe 18, 19, Caucasian young lady. She comes up to me and she, for the first time, this has happened to me a few years ago. She looks at me and she's speechless. And so we're standing in front of each other, just looking at each other. And so I break the awkward silence and I introduce myself, like, hi, how are you? Because she obviously came because she had something to say, because she walked directly to me after the panel. Introduce myself. And after I introduced myself, she burst out crying. And it was in that moment where I realized it doesn't matter what you look like. It doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter what's the color of your skin. Doesn't matter how tall or how short you are. We all are connected and we all need each other. So she's crying her eyes out, uncontrollable. And I don't know if you've ever cried like this, Kevin, but I've had some ugly cries before in my life where it's snot's coming out my nose and you just can't control it. So she's crying like that. And so a part of me is like, man, I feel, you know, there's a bunch of people. And then there were some people lined up to have a conversation with me. And so I'm trying to look for something to kind of console her. So she finally gathers herself and she tells me, I come from a religious household. I was raised in a very religious household that does not understand depression. And I'm depressed. And every time I go home and I try to share what I'm experiencing, I get pushed off to the side. And I have never in my life heard someone say that it's okay to pray and seek mental health support. And because you shared that today, I'm going to talk to a counselor.
Oh, yes.
When I tell you, bro, that messed me up. Now, I didn't cry in that moment, but after the day was done, that was something that stayed with me for so long. We ended up connecting on social media, me and this young lady. A year goes by where I kind of forget about, you know, the experience, like the situation, whatever. Year goes by, or maybe a little over a year. I get this DM. I don't know if you remember me, but my name is XYZ. We met at this conference. And you shared on a panel, and I just wanted you to know that I'm doing much better and I'm seeing a counselor, and I just wanted to say that to you. I'm like, no. Here is this petite Caucasian girl that I would think maybe we have nothing in common, who takes a little piece of information and utilize that information to change the trajectory of her life. I didn't do anything but share my story.
Yeah.
She decided to take the information and put it to action and say, I heard this and I heard this for a reason. And I'm going to use this information and I'm going to apply it and I'm going to change my life. And to this day, I kind of keep up with her on social media now that I remember who she is. And she's looking good. And I check in periodically, you know, how's it going? And, you know, it's like those are the types of experiences that, especially in this line of work, and I'm sure you experience it, and I don't want to speak for you, but sometimes it can be hard. It's like we share our life experiences at times. And yes, we're used to sharing our life experiences, but sometimes you share, and then you hear, and we hear some dark stuff sometimes, right? And sometimes there's even, you know, there can even be an ounce of, is what I'm doing even making a difference? Is what I'm doing even impacting the way that it needs to impact? And it's those stories and those experiences that make the work meaningful and reassure me that, hey, you got to keep going, brother. Like, let's go. And there are people who resonate with one experience out of all the experiences that make me who I am, that relate to one experience, that if in sharing my story, I can help someone, then it's worth doing it.
Amazing. Amazing, powerful, moving. And you changed that girl's life. And I think sometimes we're all too focused too much on all of our differences when, look, we all bleed the same blood. It's red, right? I mean, we all do. We're all human. And you touched her heart, you changed her perspective, and you got her to ask for help. And that was what you were there that day to do. That was the mission. That was the purpose. Abraham, as you are a best-selling author, I don't want to overlook that. What motivated you to write about your experiences in your books, and what do you hope readers will take away from your books, and where do people find your books?
My first book is called Unlearn the Lies, A Guide to Reshaping the Way We Think About Depression. So it looks like this. And when I sat down to write the book, it was actually once the pandemic started. And by that time, I was already doing speaking engagements. And as a speaker, you know that sometimes you got 5 minutes, sometimes you got 20 minutes, sometimes you got an hour, sometimes you got four. But none of that time is enough to really go deep into the tools, practices, and stories that can really be fleshed out to provide a meaningful experience. And so in my mind, while doing the speaking, I always knew there has to be something tangible that I have to give to this world that can help them beyond the 60 minutes that I have to speak in front of this audience. But I kept giving myself these excuses. I don't have time to write. I don't know what to write. I don't know where to start. And then this thing called the COVID-19 pandemic happens. And now I'm not traveling anywhere. I'm in my apartment. And then I hear God whisper. He says, "What's your excuse now?" So I sat my butt down, and for an hour a day, at minimum an hour a day, I wrote every day. I became disciplined with the process. And I took all of the journals that I wrote to myself when I was severely depressed in college, and I compiled all these journals, and I relived these moments, and I packaged it in this book, Unlearn the Lies. And so the reason I wrote the book is, number one, because now readers have a tangible guide that many people have told me reading the book makes them feel like I'm with them, walking with them through their process. And that's a huge, you know, piece of feedback for me, because that's the whole goal, like, so that you don't feel like you're alone. And so when I wrote the book, the whole purpose was to uncover the specific lies that we tell ourselves that keep us suffering in silence, and walk the readers through the steps that they can take to unlearn the lies and reshape the way they think about mental health in general. And so that's the goal. And as far as feedback I've received, I mentioned, you know, people feeling as if I'm right there with them as they're reading the book. But another thing is giving people the language. Like, I always share with people, hey, when you hear me say things, I don't want you to take the information and diagnose yourself. That's never my intention. This is no self-diagnosing, you know, thing. This is not what we're doing. But I want to give you the information so that you're educated enough to make an informed decision. And sometimes that informed decision is going to a mental health professional and letting them know, hey, I'm experiencing, you know, lack of sleep or whatever. I'm not eating. I'm not motivated. I have these racing thoughts. I feel like killing myself. I'm experiencing these things, and it may have something to do with mental health. Can you help me? Right. And so that's one of the things that people are saying when they read the book is, I didn't know that's what depression was. I thought that was just a part of life. I thought everyone experienced that and you just live with it. And when people have the education, then they can make the transformation. And if it wasn't for me getting the education and information, I wouldn't be able to do anything, nothing like what I'm doing today.
Very true. Can you tell us about some of the projects and initiatives you're currently involved in to promote mental health awareness and suicide prevention, like your podcast, which is also called Unlearn the Lies?
It is. So you mentioned where they can find the book. It's on Amazon. You can just search Unlearn the Lies, A Guide to Reshaping the Way We Think About Depression. So that's one thing I love to write. I love to speak. I started a small business in 2020 called Speaks to Inspire. And through that is where I do the consulting work and the speaking work, and ensuring that I'm engaging with institutions in meaningful ways. And so just that Speaks to Inspire, that's the number 2, inspire.com is where anyone can find more information. And we're really focused on how can we create these dynamic experiences on campuses so that students shift from not having conversations and not engaging with mental health services and resources to opening up in the matter of, you know, 60 minutes, opening up and saying, hey, I should try this thing. Hey, I want to try this thing. Hey, I'm going to sign up to talk to somebody. And those are the types of experiences that we want to create and cultivate throughout the country. I'm also part of a few different nonprofit organizations, which I love, love, love supporting anything in relation to ending the stigma associated with mental health and eradicating the shame around this conversation. Because in my mind, if someone kills themselves because of the shame associated with asking for help, that's a problem, because that's not even a real tangible thing that's worth allowing it to be a barrier for me. But for so long in my life, I allowed stigma to keep me silent. I was struggling. I was drinking. I was trying all these different things and did not open up because of this stupid thing called stigma, right? So if we can end stigma for all people, then I think, you know, our world can be much healthier and we can be much more connected.
Abraham, you've given us a lot to think about. You've walked us through your entire journey. You've shared how you've helped people find hope, healing, and recovery. You've shared your triumphs over adversity and the fact that you've given back through your books. We know we can connect to you through speaks2inspire.com. That's the number two. How else can listeners, watchers, viewers, subscribers of the Hindsight podcast connect with you and support your work in mental health advocacy and education? And how can someone book you?
So if you go to speaks2inspire, that's with a two, number two, inspire.com. There's information to book me to come out and speak or do a book discussion or panel discussion or book signing, whatever that looks like, whatever your interests are. Or maybe you don't know what you want to do and you just have an idea to do something. Our team can work with you to identify what type of experience can best fit your organization or institution. So that's the route you would go to book me as a speaker. As far as connecting with me outside of this podcast, I also have a podcast. It's called Unlearn the Lies About Mental Health. And I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Facebook. And it's just my first and last name, Abraham Scully. That's S-C-U-L-L-E-Y. And I'd love to connect with you. I am always, so I do a lot of these. Since COVID happened, I've been doing a lot of like Zoom meetups where there'll be somebody I see on LinkedIn and maybe they reach out and they like mental health too. And so we'll just jump on a 10-minute chat and just introduce each other. So now I have all these friends all over the world, right? That I never met in person yet, but it's because they got connected on social media. And so now we get to build these relationships and collaborate in meaningful ways.
Wonderful. Ladies and gentlemen, family and friends, this has been the Hindsight Podcast with the incredible, incomparable, phenomenal Abraham Scully. If you're looking for a great speaker, no, if you're looking for one of the best speakers on these topics, reach out to him, speaks2inspire, that's the number two.com. Get a hold of the guy. He's going to help you, help your community find hope, healing, and find a way to move forward in the face of pain. Friends, you know the drill. Be here tomorrow, every single day after that. You are loved. You are valued, you are worthy, and you matter to us. Take care, be well, and be here tomorrow. See ya.